Maria now presents Meet the Author with Ken Huck, a program designed to take a look at Catholic literature and chat with authors from around the world. Now, here's Ken Huck.
Thank you for joining me this afternoon on Meet the Author. We have a fantastic program lined up today with two guests joining us. Stay with us for the second half hour when we'll be talking with Leah Jacobson about her new book, Holistic Feminism, Healing the Identity Crisis Caused by the Women's Movement. But in this first half hour, the dynamic deacon, Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, is back with us to talk about his new book, Our Lives of Service, the Handbook for Catholic Deacons, and it's published by Ave Maria Press. It's been my experience that some areas of the country have a large number of permanent deacons, but other regions have a few, if any, in this ministry. And in either case, there's probably a lot of confusion about what this ministry is about. And some may think that a deacon performs the same roles as a priest, other than he can't celebrate Mass or hear confessions. And also, some men may feel called to this vocation, and they and their spouses, they may want more details about the ministry. Well, Deacon Harold's new book, he dives into all these areas with some help from fellow deacons. And his book is written for deacons in active ministry, inspiring reading for Catholics in the pews who are considering a call to this vocation, or those who simply want to understand the purpose and gift of the permanent diaconate. A little bit about Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. He is a Catholic author, speaker, and deacon at the Immaculate Heart Catholic Church in Portland, Oregon. He's the founder of DynamicDeacon.com, and he's also the author of, or co-author of several books. And he's been with us at least a couple occasions to talk about his book, books Behold the Man, and also his book, Father Augustus Tolkien. He co-hosts the radio show Living Stones and the Sons of Thunder podcast. He created a daily dose of Deacon Harold, which is a 30-minute weekday time of prayer and reflection, and also Walk by Faith Wednesday webinars and a weekly hour of Catholic catechesis and teaching. He earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Notre Dame and a master's degree in theological studies from the University of Dallas, and he and his wife, Colleen, have four children. Deacon Harold, it's great to have you back on the program.
Yeah, thank you so much. Ken, it's great to be back with you.
Hey, you know, you do a lot of traveling. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, you did a mission here at my parish in southeastern Ohio. Has your travel schedule gotten somewhat back to normal after the last couple years of the lockdown?
Yes, actually. What's happening now is many of the events I'm doing are rescheduled events from 2020 or early 2021. And so, yeah, I am slammed for the next several months. But I'm grateful, you know. I mean, sitting at home for over a year, you know, gave me a lot of time to think, to put things in perspective. And, you know, I'll never take, you know, traveling for granted. You know, that's for sure.
Yes. Well, you know, I think that many listeners may be surprised at just how many permanent deacons there are in the United States. I think the number is approaching 20,000, which compares to a roughly maybe 40,000 men in the priesthood. Do those numbers sound about right to you?
Yeah, there's actually closer to 30,000 deacons in the United States. Yeah, we have more deacons than any other country in the world, permanent deacons than any other country in the world. And, you know, I think this is the fruit of the Holy Spirit. You know, the diaconate has been in the church since the beginning. In Acts chapter 6, we see the first seven deacons. And then during about the late 9th, early 10th century, it transitioned from a permanent order to a transitional order in order to be a priest, but it never stopped. It never fell out. And it was until 1962 that the Second Vatican Council fathers determined to restore the diaconate to a permanent order. But interestingly, the discussion actually happened back at the Council of Trent. A lot of people don't realize that in 1545 to 1563, they brought up the idea of restoring the diaconate, but then the seminary system took over. So that was the emphasis until Vatican II.
Well, you know, I keep using the term permanent deacon or permanent diaconate, which means that there is a transitional or a temporary diaconate. Can you explain the difference?
Yeah, absolutely. Functionally, they're exactly the same. As far as the duties and responsibilities, there's nothing different. The only difference is that the transitional deacons are men in seminary that is kind of their last step before they're ordained priests. Mm. Whereas permanent deacons, we are ordained permanently to be deacons. We're not going on to the priesthood. Our main job and focus is to assist the bishop with his ministry of evangelization. So that's why at Mass, for example, the gospel, that even when a pope says Mass, a deacon reads the gospel, right? The gospel is the evangelium, the good news. And since we assist the bishop with proclaiming that good news, our role at Mass is to proclaim the good news of the gospel. So the things that we do at Mass actually parallel nicely the things that we're called to do outside of the liturgy.
Hmm. Well, you know, we often think of deacons as men who they're either retired or nearing retirement, and they answer the call to this vocation. But you were a mere babe when you joined the permanent diaconate. How old were you?
Yeah, I just turned 36.
So, wow.
So I was accepted into the program at 30, and there was no class that year, so I had to wait till next year. So 31, and it's a 5-year process, including getting a master's degree in theology. So I was 36 when I was ordained. And wow. I was the first deacon to ever ordain that was under 40. And so,
wow.
And I had very young kids at that time as well. And so we were kind of like guinea pigs, like an experiment, you know, to see, because the archbishop said, look, if we wait to ordain guys until their kids are older, then we're going to have basically elderly deacons. But canon law says the earliest age is 35. So, you know, we're going to ordain you, but, you know, you're kind of like a test case. And if this works, then we'll consider on a case-by-case basis other men that are younger with smaller children. But again, it's definitely a case-by-case basis.
Well, that brings up a good point. You encourage young men to consider this vocation. And I think there may be reluctance, and you talk about all this in your book, because there may be young children at home, there's careers, there's economic reasons. What do you say to young men who may be feeling that tug, that call to the diaconate, and keep thinking, well, I'll get around to it someday, maybe once the kids are out of the house or, you know, more established financially? What's your message to them?
Yeah, the number one, talk with your wife. That's definitely number one. I mean, there's no way that you can move forward in even discerning a vocation to the diaconate without having serious and significant conversations with your wife, and to listen to her heart. I believe truly, Ken, that the Holy Spirit speaks through wives, and if we as husbands don't listen to the voice of the Spirit speaking through them, we're idiots. So I would tell the guy, listen to your wife. Now, if your wife, now my wife was, because I was a Benedictine monk in my 20s, so she knew that I already had this desire to serve. And that it wasn't going away. And so in our situation, even though our kids were very young, she was very supportive in me discerning a path to the diaconate. In other cases, it may be the wife is not comfortable. She goes, you know, serving as a deacon may mean that you're away from home for a long time, and, you know, and I don't want to take care of the kids by myself and that kind of thing. So it really needs to be discerned. But to have that conversation with your wife as part of this process is absolutely critical.
Well, again, today on Meet the Author here on Radio Maria, we're talking with Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers about his book, Our Life of Service, The Handbook for Catholic Deacons. Your book is titled Our Life of Service. Who is it that the deacons are serving? You mentioned the bishop, but are they serving the people? Are they serving the pastor in the parish? What do you mean by a life of service?
Yeah, so a deacon, by his very nature, is a sacramental sign, a permanent sign and witness of the ministry of Christ the servant. So we are ordained to be servants. So what does that look like? So what happens in the discernment process that we were just talking about, Ken, is that a man may feel that he's being called. And if his wife and pastor kind of, you know, confirm, okay, yeah, we think, you know, you'd be a good fit, then they begin the process of discernment. But the church is also discerning if this man is called or not. And one of the things they look at is he serving well in his family? So that's why I have in the book, serving your wife and serving your children. Because what's happening is that the church recognizes that this particular man is serving well as the diaconia, if you will, the diaconate of the family. And so the church is saying, can we use these gifts for the service of the entire church? And that's what's happening there. Of course, that a deacon serves in the parish and then serves outside of the parish. And we see that very clearly, for example, Acts of the Apostles. We see Stephen, who was the first martyr, the first person to die for Christ, who was a deacon. And he wasn't in church when he got martyred. He was out preaching. Philip, we also see in Acts of the Apostles with the Ethiopian eunuch. He wasn't in a parish. He was out preaching and met the Ethiopian eunuch and catechized him and baptized him. You know, so it's we have a very rich ministry both inside and outside the parish, all designed to build up the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were assigned, when you were ordained, you were assigned by your bishop to your home parish, which I believe is pretty often the case. But, you know, there's that line of scripture where Jesus says, a prophet is not without honor except in his native place and among his own kin and his own house. Is there often issues when here's a man, he's been in the parish, people know him as, you know, that's Joe over there, and suddenly he is Deacon Joe, and people are going, wait a minute, I know him. There's some idea that they don't think of him as a deacon because, you know, he's been with them, just like Jesus was kind of rejected in his hometown. Have you run into that, or you had other deacons tell you that?
Well, Ken, you know, that was you hit the nail on the head. That was a big concern for me because the parish that I'm here, because I grew up in New Jersey, but the parish I'm here in Oregon, never had a deacon before. And all of a sudden, you know, and I went to Father, I said, Father, I'm a little concerned because they've always known me as Harold and they see me, you know, St. Vincent de Paul and altar serving and lecturing and all these other things that I'm doing. But, you know, a year from now, I'm going to be Deacon Harold, and they may not accept that, or they may think I'm trying to take their job, or something like that. And so what Father did was he helped to prepare the people after the closing prayer, like during the announcements. He would just say a little 30-second thing. Oh, by the way, you see Deacon Harold serving here as an acolyte. This time next year, he'll be Deacon Harold. He'll be doing this, and here's why. Boom. And then do that again, you know, like a couple times a month. And then put a couple things in the book. And so he prepared people. And it was wonderful. So all my fears were alleviated. I had not one issue, I think, because Father laid the groundwork. Now you have other deacons who the priests don't really understand. You know, you're competing with lay ministry, which is not what's supposed to be happening at all. And because they don't understand the diaconate, sometimes guys have to move to a different parish because... they're having issues in the parish that they were in before.
Well, that's something you talk about in your book. By the way, for our listeners, the book, it's titled Our Life of Service, The Handbook for Catholic Deacons. It was written by Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. You talk about this. You know, there's a deacon, he's assigned to a parish. Maybe it's his home parish, maybe it's not. And sometimes, you know, there are people, laity, who are either paid staff or been volunteers who have been doing various ministries throughout the church or parish for a number of years. And then all of a sudden this deacon comes in and they're thinking, well, he's going to, you know, either take my job or he's going to replace me. This is a ministry I love. And you talk about that in your book, about how to kind of smooth that over, how to assure people you're not there to push anybody out. And I never really thought about that too much, but I could understand how that could be an issue where a deacon comes in and all of a sudden, you know, people who they're, you know, literally worried about being pushed out of some ministry that they love or even their job, if you will. So that's a good point. That's another reason for people to read this book and understand, some of the issues there. Deacons assist the pastor at Mass in a variety of ways. And on occasion, the deacon may give the homily. It's my understanding that the bishop has to give permission for the deacon to give a homily in his diocese. Do I have that right? Is it up to the bishop to make that decision?
Well, in order to be able to even function as a deacon, you have to have what's called faculties. That means you receive permission from the bishop not only to give homilies, but even to do baptisms, weddings, funerals, to even function as a deacon. So after you're ordained, you get an official letter with the diocesan seal on it from the bishop that says, here is what I am authorizing you to do as a deacon. And it lists specifically the things that the deacon can do within the parish boundaries. So in fact, Kenby, when I travel, I have to get a letter. My diocese has to send a letter to the diocese I'm going to saying that, yes, I'm in good standing. There's nothing preventing me from serving. And then that bishop has to approve that and give me permission to function as a deacon in that diocese, which includes preaching.
Wow. I didn't realize that. That's amazing that as much as you travel, you must have a cabinet full of those letters at this point.
I think the diocese hired a part-time person just to deal with my stuff. So
here's, you know, I was looking at the church calendar today, and today is the official feast day of Saint Blaise. And of course, most of our listeners know Saint Blaise because of the throat blessing. Is that something that you, as a permanent deacon, can do? Can you give the blessing of throats probably over this coming weekend as a deacon, or is that something that's reserved to the priest?
Yeah, deacons can do that. In fact, it's very clear, Ken. There's something called the Book of Blessings, and in that book, it says very clearly what bishops can do, what priests can do, what deacons can do, and even what lay people can do. You know, and so obviously bishops can do everything, right? A priest can do probably 90% because there's some things only a bishop can do, like, for example, consecrating a new altar in a church. Only a bishop can do that, right? And then there's about deacons can do about 70% of the things in there, and then lay people can do maybe about half or a little less of the blessings that are given in that book. So we have to go according to the Book of Blessings, and in fact, before the blessing, it says whether who has permission, whether the priest or the deacon or a layperson can give permission to give that particular blessing. So when it comes to throats, I know because I've done it. So deacons can give that blessing.
Well, and you say in the book that one of the things that's given you great satisfaction in your vocation is visiting people. You know, shut-ins, people who are elderly in, say, nursing homes or hospitals. You know, when you think about, especially in a larger parish and everything that the pastor has to do, you can understand how having a permanent deacon there to assist him would be a huge thing. I mean, to visit men in jail. To do all those visits, that would take up such an inordinate amount of time for the pastor. That, but you said in the book that you receive a lot of joy when you do that. Is that one of the most joyful aspects of your vocation?
Absolutely, Ken. You know, some people think when they talk to me, well, what's the most fulfilling part of your diaconal ministry? And they think I'm going to say, well, being on EWTN or writing books or traveling around the world. But it's just as you said, Ken, it's how we get to be in people's lives, that great gift of being with people in those difficult moments, in those trying moments, when they're struggling with their faith, when a loved one is sick, when they're in prison, they made a mistake and they're paying for it, and you're representing the church for them in those moments. That's the most beautiful part about the diaconal ministry for me.
You also explained that education in the faith is also a large part of your ministry. What kind of things? Well, you travel so much, but for a typical, more typical permanent deacon, are they involved with things like RCIA, confirmation, adult education, child education? What kind of things do they do in that area?
Yes, all of the above. and the important thing, Ken, what has to be discerned is a person's gifts. So, you know, maybe a deacon has a gift for teaching. So maybe he can work well with RCIA or adult education. Or maybe he has a different gift or a different facility that can help the priest in his in the parish. So that has to be discerned by the priest. How can this deacon, given his gifts, best serve this parish? Some guys love going to the prisons. Some guys, like I was in law enforcement for 23 years. Prison ministry doesn't appeal to me because I used to put people in there. You know, some guys, like, you know, they don't like going to the hospital because it just, you know, it really it kind of makes them ill, you know. So you have to just discern what are the gifts that this man has that can be used in service to the church. So or, again, you don't want to take the place of a DRE in a parish because, quite frankly, they may have more education than you do. But you can go and, for example, make sure that the resources that they're using are faithful to the church, or give a guest lecture on a particular topic that the deacon is well versed in, or something like that. You know, so you have to find creative ways to work together.
Well, I think this book is so encouraging. And like you said, a lot of men are answering the call, but there's always room for more. We can always use more or, you know, faith-filled men in, you know, in parishes to provide an example, not only to other men, but also to younger, you know, boys to see, you know, here's something to strive for. I read off all these things that, in your bio, all these things you're doing. Where's the best place for people to go to find out more about you, find out about these podcasts that you do, find out more about your books, or maybe invite you to a parish to or an event to come and speak? Where's the best place to contact you?
I made it really easy. DeaconHarold.com. Everything is there.
Well, I was thinking every time I see your name, my confirmation name is Harold, so I always it always resonates with me when I see your name. It was in honor of my uncle, who was my sponsor in my case. But anyway, for our listeners again, the book, it's titled Our Life of Service, The Handbook for Catholic Deacons. It was written by my guest, Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, published by Ave Maria Press, and you can get it on their website or just about any place that great books are sold. Check out his website and check out all these different resources that he has. And for anyone who's listening, either men or maybe there's the spouse of a man out there who's listening, and your husband has maybe mentioned a diaconate, and you know he's thinking about it. So buy him this book, encourage him. And make that phone call to the diocese and find out when the next class begins and get on board. So, Deacon Harold, I can't thank you enough for coming on today.
Well, thank you for having me, Ken. It's been great to be with you and to be back on Radio Maria again. Remember, I started off, I had a little show on there called From the Rooftops. Years
yeah,
back.
And you're one of the authors I have met. You and I actually met, we met briefly, I think, when you were here a few years ago, but I think at Chicago at the Catholic Book Fair, we had a brief chat.
Oh,
boy,
right.
That was probably nine years ago. So take care. I look forward to having you back again.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Fantastic book. Anyone who's considering the diaconate, or if you know someone who's considering it, get this book. We're going to take a music break. When we get back, Leah Jacobson will be with us to talk about her book, Holistic Feminism, and that's spelled with WHOLISTIC, not, you know, so she gets jokes, I guess, that everybody looks at this and said, why did you spell it that way? So we'll find out when we come back and talk with Leah.
Give thanks with a grateful heart. give thanks to the Holy One. Give thanks because He's given Jesus Christ, His Son.
You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now return to Meet the Author with Ken Huck.
Hey, welcome back. You know, is there a more controversial or contentious word than the word feminism? And perhaps surprising, the word is divisive even for women who consider themselves feminists. What's going on and how and why did this divide occur? Well, to explain this and much more, my next guest is Leah Jacobson, and she's written a book titled Holistic Feminism, Healing the Identity Crisis Caused by the Women's Movement, and it's published by Lumen Press and Media. And Leah gives us a history of the different waves of the feminist movement and illustrates how the American women's movement was hijacked by the sexual revolution. And she explains that young women have been told lies about their bodies and their expectations. A little bit about Leah. She is an international speaker, nonprofit founder, board certified lactation consultant, and now author. And having worked with young people and mothers since the year 2000, she founded the Guiding Star Project back in 2011 after feeling called to help women and families by providing resources that honor natural law and promote holistic feminism. Guiding Star centers offer pregnancy support, breastfeeding help, fertility education, drop-in childcare, and much more. And one of her greatest passions is supporting young women as they transition into their roles as new mothers. Leah resides in central Minnesota with her husband and seven children. With that, Leah, welcome to Meet the Author.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Ken. I'm happy to be on with you today.
Hey, this book is great. I learned so much in reading this, and it really made me think. I found myself talking with people about it here over the last few days. We need to point out at the very beginning of our discussion that there have been some fantastic benefits from the earlier women's movements. And your book honors these gains, right? You're not against the women's movement or feminism. Matter of fact, you probably consider yourself a feminist, right?
Yeah, I do. I would consider myself a feminist. And I think that there is room for, you know, people within the church to align with elements of feminism, especially the ones that are focused on human dignity and social justice and equality. Those are principles that most feminists would espouse and take up. And those are also things that, you know, most faithful Christians also would identify with.
Well, and we also need to say that not all women have had the same experiences. For example, you grew up, you talk about this in your book, you grew up on a dairy farm in a community where women and girls were treated as equals, were given tremendous responsibility and respect for their contributions. Did you ever feel like a second-class gender as a young woman?
No, absolutely not, actually. And that was the interesting part for me when I left that small rural community that I had grown up with. I was kind of confused a little bit by some of the anger that women had directed at men, directed at the church, directed in all sorts of different directions, because I didn't feel that way growing up. I didn't feel like I was under the thumb of the patriarchy in any way. And so it wasn't an experience that I identified with naturally.
Hmm. Well, you talk about some of those events of hostility that you experienced over the years. Some of them are pretty difficult, you know, where people ridiculed you in public and challenged you, and you're, as I'm reading this, I'm going, oh my gosh, how's a person supposed to respond to this hostility? Just give us one example. I think it was one I'm thinking about is you got married right after college, and you and your husband were living on campus, and you just faced this hostility from an older professor, I think.
Yeah, that's she was an administrator, a campus administrator, actually, and she is one of many that made comments about, you know, well, you're wasting your life, you're wasting your education. Like, you know, it's just so sad that you got pregnant. It's so sad that you got married. You're only 22. And I remember just looking at her and going, like, I'm an adult. Like, I'm grown up. I have a great education. I have a great support system, a great network here. There's nothing wrong with my baby and my body doing this. It was just kind of a bewildering thing for me to realize that older women, specifically in academia, really see young motherhood as part of the problem. And I never grew up with that understanding. I always grew up with the understanding that a healthy female fertile body, that's a beautiful gift, and that the babies that come from that union, it's all gift to society. It's one of the greatest things that we can do, self-sacrificially and lovingly.
Hmm. Well, again, for our listeners here today on Meet the Author, we're talking with Leah Jacobson about her book, Holistic Feminism, Healing the Identity Crisis Caused by the Women's Movement. You know, it's as I'm reading your book, you know, I was thinking that, one of the things that you point out in your book that made me think about this, you say that some in the feminist movement have tried to make the case that men and women are completely interchangeable in the workplace. And, you know, my experience, multi-decade experience, our observation has been that that one aspect of this message is that for young women to compete in the workplace, they must be just one of the guys. And unfortunately, that seemed to imply taking on the worst characteristics of guys, of men, coarse language, over-aggressiveness,
absolutely,
drinking, pornography, everything.
Am I
off base on this, or this? And you actually explain how this idea of interchangeability actually has hurt women in the workplace, right?
I think so. I think so tremendously. I think that what happened, you know, in that second wave of the feminist movement, where there was this rallying cry of, you know, to be a good feminist, to be a good, you know, part of the women's movement, that you were called to be out of the home and you were called to have a job and a career, and that was something that was, you know, kind of required of women. But at that moment in time where they made that shift into the workforce, they really just didn't take into account, you know, women's natural gifts. And they really succumbed to the current kind of cultural ideas at that point, where things like empathy and emotional capacity, you know, some of these gifts that women have at that point in time were really seen as weaknesses professionally. You know, men that espoused, you know, emotive capacity in a meeting were seen as, you know, not very professional or businesslike. And so when women brought some of their natural gifts and qualities into the workplace, it was seen as weaknesses. And women were really encouraged to suppress, you know, some of their feminine gifts. This is long before we had, you know, emotional, you know, intelligence tests. Like, EQ wasn't a thing yet at that point. And so the workplace was a very masculine, aggressive, productivity-driven place, which are all a little bit opposed to a woman's natural gifts, her natural gifts of relationship and hospitality and friendship. And those things are missing in a traditional corporate world. And I think it's because we kind of missed out on embracing women as they naturally excel.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense, you know, I think, what you're saying about
does.
The coarseness of men, women that are truly embracing their gifts in that setting, they elevate men, you know, by being different, by not engaging in these sort of masculine, aggressive, dominant sort of behaviors. When women opt out of that and, you know, hold men to a higher standard, it changes the entire environment, but that's not what happened. Women felt the pressure to fit in and perform like the men and be like the men and be very productive. And so I think you're absolutely right. A lot of women did adopt very masculine standards in the workplace.
Yeah. Well, again, the book, it's titled Holistic Feminism. By the way, tell our listeners how it's spelled. I was watching a podcast or another that you did, and I guess you get some people saying, why did you spell it, that the title that way?
Yeah, with a W. It's holistic as in whole, so W-H-O-L-I-S-T-I-C, Holistic Feminism. And it really is this idea of holism that, you know, previous waves of the women's movement have really dissected out, that, you know, the female mind, body, and spirit have been completely broken into separate elements. And they try to say, you know, your mind can overrule your body, and the feminine spirit is this ethereal sort of thing that's not real. And we're saying that it's the mind and the body and the spirit are all created as one, and that if you are not caring for all of them together holistically as one, you are not going to be happy. You are not going to find fulfillment and purpose. You're not going to know who you were created to be. You have to be whole.
One of the needs I think your book fulfills is, you know, we hear a lot of, you know, we hear about a lot of young women rejecting their faith, rejecting the church. They see the church as hostile to women. They don't see it compatible with feminism because of the version of feminism that they have been given in the secular world does not seem to match the vision of feminism that the church has. Would you say that your book, again, tries to heal that divide that shows that this message of feminism, the secular version, is not the correct version, that the church actually has a view of feminism that is more in line with the way God intended it?
Absolutely. And, you know, the church's version of feminism predates the feminist movement by, you know, thousands of years. The church's version of female equality and human dignity and the right to bodily autonomy and, you know, the complementarity of man and woman, that is existed long before the feminist movement of the 1960s and 70s in the United States. It's a very recent understanding of what it means to love women the way that they currently, you know, kind of define it. And really, the purest definition of kind of this second wave of radical feminism, it can just be boiled down into reproductive rights. You really believe that contraception and abortion are the primary issues that every feminist needs to unite around, and all these other sort of things that actually matter in the daily lives of millions of women around the world, you know, such as access to good health care, such, you know, all these things, that those are sort of secondary issues. And I think the church has a much broader understanding of women's needs, you know, holistically and globally than this very narrow kind of privileged feminist movement does.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I had an author on who had written a book on the church during the so-called Dark Ages, and we were talking about the evolution of some of the sacraments during that period. And one of the things that the author brought up was how the sacrament of marriage evolved during that time period, where it became one of the key aspects of the sacramental marriage is that a woman has to freely agree to marriage, which we think of today, of course, right? Well, he said prior to the church coming along, women weren't given a lot of choice in this marriage decision. It was like, you know, here's the person you're going to marry, and it was never the woman had no say in the matter. And it was actually the Catholic Church that brought the freedom for women to decide whether or not they would be married, you know, into the culture as a part of the sacrament. So as you point out,
that is such a great example. I mean, that's such a great example of the church looking out for, you know, just the dignity of the human person and free will being respected and understood. And one of the things I love about, you know, John Paul II with his theology of the body, just explaining the complementarity of the physical body and the marital act and all that stuff, like there's just so much beauty and dignity just packed into all of his writings. And he specifically called for, you know, the church to embrace a new feminism. He used that term, new feminism. And he said, you know, it's up to the women of the church to embrace this idea that and reject these sort of old models, these old political and these old, you know, legislative models of governance that are aggressive and male dominated. It's up to women to bring their unique feminine genius into the life of the world and into every area of society and culture. You know, John Paul II is very clear about that. He talks about it in his letter to women. You know, he says, women who work, women who are mothers, women who stay home, women, you know, he addresses all the women of the world in whatever way they identify. And he just really affirms and calls them out and says, we see you. Like, this is a valid place to live out your life. Like, women who are, you know, sisters, women who are single. I just think that's so important for us to recognize that the church has a much more generous and broad way for women to live out their individual gifts than secular feminism and the world. And in many ways, you know, this movement that's saying we want to free women, we want to liberate women, we want to, you know, widen their options. In reality, what it did is it narrowed down to a very small pathway of what success looks like for women. And success for women in our modern culture looks like you have a
successful,
I'm
glad you brought that up. You know, I was intending, I completely forgot about bringing this up with you, Leah, is you mentioned this in the beginning of your book when they have done, I'll call them satisfaction surveys of women over the, you know, decades. You would think that with this so-called the liberation movement, empowering women, et cetera, that women would be happier, more fulfilled. But the data that you present in your book, it really doesn't show that, does it?
We are not. We are very miserable. We are more depressed, more anxious. We're pretty miserable right now on whole. And interestingly, the groups of women that showed the highest levels of, you know, negative fall, so basically when you track it from the 1970s to modern time right now, the group of women that had the most negative effect were white women, older white women, like over the age of like 60. So it's the women who fully, fully embraced this wave of feminism that said, you know, have a career, you can do it all, like, put your kids in childcare, you don't need that marriage. Like, just so many of the kind of ideologies and ideas that they fully embraced have brought the most misery.
Yeah, it's, yeah, you present some very convincing evidence there in your book that this, you know, this freedom has caused a lot of grief for a lot of women. And like you said, women who've gotten into their 40s and 50s, maybe they've delayed marriage, having children, now they're unable to have children. You know, they put all their effort into their careers. The marriage hasn't worked out because of that, because of this idea that career is everything.
Well, and let's be honest, this wasn't all women's fault. Like, these marriages that are falling apart, like, what this movement also created with men was an expectation that, you know, marriage was not necessarily fruitful, that you know, women also were going to be working. Like, the men also had expectations that women fit this model of success. And so they expected their wives to be at work, but they also expected them, you know, to do all these other things. And it's just not compatible with family life and the way women have naturally been created. And what really brings us joy, what brings most women joy, is a mix of creative outlet and a mix of time really able to be devoted to your children and to your community and relationships.
Well, and I think it created economic expectations for women to always be that second paycheck. Let's face it, the second paycheck in the American family has really, for the most part, increase the living standard of people, but at a cost, though, because now people have this expectation of that there will always be that second income. So you purchased maybe a house or made financial decisions based on the fact that there would always be that second income. So now when it comes time to for a woman who's maybe in her mid-30s and it's, you know, thinking, I need, you know, if I want to have children, I have to do it now. But now financially, you can't make that decision because of the earlier decisions about, well, there's always going to be that second paycheck coming in. And now we can't afford, you can always afford children, but it makes it more difficult. It may look impossible because of those decisions.
I think that's a very real, representation of just the tension and the stress that we have created in this system for modern women. You know, yeah, you can do it all. You can have it all. Like, you're liberated, you're free, but really, are you free to choose the simple things? Are you free to choose the things that make you happy? Not so much.
Yeah. Well, the book, it's Holistic Feminism, Healing the Identity Crisis Caused by the Women's Movement. Two questions. One is your book, it's published. Well, where's the best place for listeners to purchase your book?
Yeah, Lumen Press is the publishing arm of my nonprofit, actually. So Guiding Star Project is my nonprofit. And we put it out under lumenpress.org. You can purchase the book there. It's also up on Amazon, but we prefer you go through Lumen Press if you're willing to. It makes it a little easier for us, lumenpress.org. That's where you can purchase it.
I also wanted to talk about, by the way, for our listeners, on the Meet the Author Facebook page, I put links to the Guiding Star Project, Lumen Press, where all this is out there. So if you're in your car, don't worry about trying to remember all this. Just get on Facebook and go to those links. Tell us more about this this Guiding Star Project, which you founded about 10 years ago. It sounds like there's a variety of centers, and what are they all there in your area, or are they scattered around the country?
No. I'm in Minnesota, so that's kind of where this idea and this thing was born. I worked in campus ministry at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and that's where our story really began and unfolded. But there's actually only one Guiding Star Center in the state of Minnesota right now. and so the other five of them are in three other states, and we're about to announce our seventh center in our sixth state. Very shortly, we're about to announce that. But they're kind of growing and popping up all over the country. And, you know, the book, I finally got time, I think, to sit down and kind of capture the worldview, the why of Guiding Star. You know, we've been doing Guiding Star, we've been opening these centers, and it resonates with people, and they understand it instinctively because it's not coming from a religious argument. It's not saying, you know, morally this is the way that women's health care should be. It's a very natural law proposition of, you know, how are women's bodies created, and when they're healthy, how should they operate? You know, they should naturally ovulate, gestate, and lactate. That's the unique female superpowers. And so these Guiding Star centers were built on just that very basic notion of what should an authentic women's healthcare center do? Well, it should provide care for natural fertility, natural childbirth, and natural breastfeeding. Wow. So that's the premise of our centers. And we finally, COVID was a hidden gift. I got COVID and I got sick and I was stuck home and I took 8 weeks and I wrote the book.
That's when life gives you lemons, right? You make that lemonade. So,
It was just time for us because this is the worldview that we live every day in our centers. This is the kind of care that we think women deserve. This is what we think the feminist and the women's movement should look like. It should tell women the truth about their bodies, that you're good and you don't need to suppress and alter and destroy yourself for some, you know, false notion of happiness and productivity. You are good the way you are, and the world needs to accommodate women's bodies the way they naturally were created, not the other way around, because women have been accommodating their bodies for society for far too long.
Well, I want to end with something you had in your book. You're a lactation consultant. You have some statistics in there. I just found this kind of very interesting, breastfeeding hit a low in the early or mid 70s at less than 25% of all new mothers would breastfeed their children because they were told, well, they were probably told, you have to get back to work, you can't do this, put your child on formula, and also there wasn't allowances made in the workplace for new mothers to store their milk, you know, at work. And you talk about that in your book also. And now that ship has turned, and now it's back up into what, the 70s or 80% number now?
Yeah, it's upper 70s, low 80s. Yeah, it's really done a huge turn.
Yeah, I'm a retired engineer. Numbers make, you know, statistics. I just looked at that and I said, well, that's a dramatic change, both on the downturn and then on the up. You know, this idea that women were told, no, you don't do this. Just, you know, like you said, put your baby on formula and get back to work. And that's one of those ideas we've been talking about where women were treated, you know, exactly like men in the workplace. And that's what someone in the feminist movement wanted. They wanted interchangeability of men and women in the workplace. Yeah. And that is one of the downsides. And that comes through loud and clear in your book, that the damage that was done by that attitude. So great book.
It's incredibly hurtful to women. But I think there's just so much hope in those numbers, too. Because if you can change that in 40 years, you can change a lot.
Yeah. You great work, great book. Hope people check it out. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
All right. Take care. That was Leah Jacobson. The book is Holistic Feminism, Healing the Identity Crisis Caused by the Women's Movement. Great book. Next week, we are going to have a guest. She is Kristen Van, she pronounces her name Uden, but I think it's actually Uden. Is the original pronunciation. She is a publicist for Sophia Institute Press. She's going to come on and talk about three books that they're classic books published by the Sophia Institute that are perfect for Lent. It's hard to believe, but yes, Lent begins in about 4 weeks. I think we're 4 weeks away from Ash Wednesday. And, you know, if you're looking for to do something to get ready or during the Lenten season to get ready for Easter, she's going to talk about these three books. One of them is What Jesus Saw from the Cross. Another one is The Pain of Christ and the Sorrow of God. And finally, 33 Years in the Holy Land. We also have a second guest next week, Joel Stempanek. He's been on the program before, and it's the book he's going to be talking about is Beginning Well, Seven Spiritual Practices for the First Year of Almost Anything. So next week, busy week, we're going to be talking about four books with two different guests. So until then, goodbye and God bless.